So anything I say after now will be recorded?
Yes.
Great start to the talk.
We're pleased to have Jim Howerson today, who will talk about matter from geometry without resolution.
All right. So hello, everyone. As Dave said, my name is Jim. I am a postdoc over at the KITP, and today I'm going to tell you about a paper called Matter from Geometry Without Resolution that I put out on the archive with Antonella Grassi and Julia Shaneson in June. They are both mathematicians at the University of Pennsylvania and friends of mine, and this was a very fun project. I will say that I am a physicist, and this is a physics paper, but there are some new ideas here that we're hoping to write a math paper on in the near future, and hopefully that'll start soon. So one thing I do want to point you to is there are a number of papers that are in the same spirit of what I'll tell you about today. One of the original ones was one by Sheldon Katz and Kumran Vaha in 1996 called Matter from Geometry. And they used resolution, and I will not use resolution. So that is part of the fun of this talk. Dave had a couple of papers actually with Antonella in 2000 and 2011. Dave had a paper with Wadi Taylor at MIT in 2011, and maybe I will also plug myself here. I gave a very similar talk, a slightly longer version of it, at the Simons Workshop this summer, and that is videotaped online if you, for some reason, can't get enough of this subject. And also, since I know I'll forget to mention it during the talk, all of the computations that I'm going to talk about today were tedious and were done with the computer code, and if you're interested in this sort of thing, that is publicly available, and there's a nice manual that tells you how to use the functions. If you're interested in that, ask me about it afterwards. So ultimately, mathematically, this talk is about the deformation and resolution of singular elliptic vibrations, which is a classic subject in mathematics. And when physicists usually talk about such subjects, they're often talking about gauge theories in four dimensions with n equals 2 supersymmetry. We heard a talk about this by Andres Melmendier a few weeks ago that took the n equals 2 perspective, and Wenbin Yan over at KITP gave a related talk yesterday. But I'm not going to talk about n equals 2 theories today. So the mathematics, if you're not interested in matter, which I don't know why you wouldn't be, you can use many of these same techniques in analyzing n equals 2 theories. So in particular, Seiberg-Witten theory has a Seiberg-Witten curve, which is an elliptic vibration over the Coulomb branch of that theory. So matter is a subject that needs no introduction. So let me start with casting the line very far out and then maybe in trying to reel it back in. I'll ask a good question. So there are three letters, LHC, that perhaps you did not expect me to write on the board today in a math physics seminar. And famously, on July 4th, 2012, last year, the two experiments, CMS and ATLAS, at the Large Hadron Collider, announced the discovery of the Higgs boson. Okay. And this was a great discovery, and I think it was October 8th, just a few weeks ago, the Nobel Prize was awarded in physics to the theorists who theorized about this in the 60s. And, you know, this is a new particle, fundamental particle in nature. It's the last piece of the Standard Model of Particle Physics that was missing, and it has been discovered as of last year. So this is a very exciting thing. One of the other features of the LHC to this point is that it's been Higgs boson plus nothing. So you might have heard physicists talking about supersymmetry for the last number of years, not the kind that we would use in Seiberg-Witten theory, but a related type with less supersymmetry that might be relevant for particle physics. And we expected it to show up. It may still show up, but it's overdue at this point. We have not seen it. And so this fact has left a lot of people scratching their heads. Another thing that's sort of going on simultaneously is dark matter direct detection experiments. So remember that dark matter is matter that makes up 80% of the matter in the universe. The stuff that makes up you and me and everything around us that we know is only 20% of the matter in the universe. So this is a very significant thing, but we don't know too much about its particle content yet. So there have been various experiments which have been trying to detect its existence. If this axis is sigma, the spin-independent scattering cross-section, this is the thing you want to measure at experiments to try to discover this new type of matter. and this is energy. There's this plot that has become famous over the last few years where a lot of experiments have claimed to see something roughly in this region, and some of these regions are overlapping, but others aren't. And that has been the cause for some excitement. But then what is commonly considered the best experiment, which is Xenon 100, and I should say that another experiment called Lux will release its first data next week, which is also believed to say something important here, they have come through with an exclusion curve that looks something like this. Okay, and so there's a lot of hope that we'll learn something about dark matter in the next 10 years or so, particularly if it couples to certain standard model particles. But this is something that is an interesting experimental situation that is very much under debate and is a very important problem. So like I said at the beginning, matter is not really something that I need to motivate.
What you wrote out, that's really 10 GeV or just the number? The minimum of that number there?
What I meant to draw is I meant to line up the detection regions where people have claimed detection roughly with 10 GeV.
It's really just 10 GeV.
That's right. There are a number of signals that people are excited about, that the particle physicists are excited about, and one of them happens to be in the 5 to 10 GeV range. And then there are a couple others.
Also, for the Higgs boson, what really affects the Higgs boson is Higgs light.
It is officially called a Higgs boson now. Yeah. But people were very conservative for a while and called it Higgs-like, but it's really called a Higgs boson now. So both of these things have left particle theorists scratching their heads, and for a long time, there was hope that string theory might tell you something interesting about particle physics. What we've learned since then, so maybe what the hope was in the 80s, so in 1984, this first string revolution happened, which was the year I was born. And so I wasn't around for that. And I think the hope in the years immediately following was that the theory would be so constraining that it would give you one gauge theory at low energies that would describe the world. But now we believe that there's a large landscape of vacua. And each vacuum has a gauge particle sector in it, most do, at low energies. And so what you have is this large collection of gauge theories that are arising from string vacua. And if one is our world, the question is which one. And so the top-down question that I would like to ask, which is a little different from the usual question, given these difficulties of having many gauge theories, the question that I would like to ask is, are the gauge theories that are arising in the most generic set possible, how do stringy gauge theories, by which I mean gauge theories that arise at low energy in a string compactification, how are they contained in the larger set of gauge theories? And I think based on what we know to date, this really is a proper subset. There are things that people like to say, you can do anything you want, but that's just really not true. One of the things that I'll address today, and which physics-wise led to this project, is asking the question, what sorts of matter representations can you get? So in a gauge theory, your particles are fields that are in representations of various Lie algebras, and in quantum field theory, which is the theory that describes the standard model, there's really no limitations on any particular representation. There are constraints on sets of representations, but there's no limitation on a particular representation. So one thing that's interesting in the landscape, in the string landscape, is that the representation theory is limited.
Okay. Are you limiting the Lie group?
Pardon?
Are you limiting the Lie group to SU3, SU2, SU1?
I'm not, no. I'm wanting to consider the set of gauge theories that might arise in string theory, whether or not similar to the standard model, with respect to the full set of gauge theories that you might possibly consider.
So any Lie group, any complex Lie group response.
That's right. Okay. That's right. But the point is that in the gauge theories that tend to arise in string compactifications, there are limitations not only on the matter representations, the Lie algebra representations, but often on the gauge group as well. There's some sort of string constraint that likes the rank to be low, where there is no corresponding constraint in quantum field theory. So all I wanted to say here is that these matter representations that are limited, just to give a few examples, in the weakly coupled type 2 string, The 16-dimensional spinner representation of SO10 cannot be obtained, and when people are interested in building SO10 guts for talking about particle physics unification, this is the representation of SO10 that the standard model fields fit into. So the fact that you can't get it in weakly coupled type 2 string theory is an interesting fact, and it's showing you that in that corner of the landscape, you can't just get any gauge theory you want. Now, if you go to other corners of the landscape, you can get the 16 of SO10, but to date, there's a representation that particle physicists sometimes study, the 126-dimensional representation of SO10, and I know of no realization of this as a light state arising in the landscape. So there's this interesting question, which is what are the Lie algebra representations that are possible? So part of the limitation in the type 2 case was that it's coming from quantizations of open strings, and there's only so many representations you can get. But when you go to strong coupling, to what's known as M-theory or F-theory, which I'll talk about in a minute, matter becomes geometrized. So you get matter from geometry. So in particular, when this happens, there's more possibilities than there would be in the standard weakly coupled cases. And the way that it arises from geometry is certain properties of two cycles of the geometry, particularly if you blow it down, those two cycles can fill out certain ADE representations, and the particles in the theory inherit the ADE structure, more generically, Lie group structure, from the geometry. So in particular, one thing that you might want to study is M-theory compactified to four dimensions on seven-dimensional manifolds with G2 holonomy, but these are notoriously difficult objects to construct compared to Calabi-Yau fourfolds or Calabi-Yau threefolds.
When you say geometry, do you really mean geometry or you mean topology? You use the word two cycles. You mean that's more topology.
Yes, geometry. Absolutely. I'm using the word geometry vaguely. That's right. The representation theoretic structure of the particles at low energies is coming from the topological nature of the manifolds, or varieties. So because these are hard to construct, I'd like to propose in this talk that we talk a little bit about F-theory. So F-theory is a compactification of a theory that I'll tell you about in a second on a geometry that is an elliptic vibration over a D-dimensional Calabi-Yau manifold. It's an elliptic vibration over a D-1 dimensional base. So if I want to compactify to four dimensions, I need an elliptically fibered Calabi-Yau fourfold. So why F-theory? One point of view on F-theory is that it exists and is beautiful, and so you should study it. That's not the most practical viewpoint. One that I like is that it may give you the broadest view of the string landscape that we have to date. So we're learning a lot about the string landscape over time, but if you want to talk about what regions can you construct the manifold broadly, study its moduli spaces and its low energy features, whether cosmologically or particle or just existence motivated, this is the region that perhaps to date is the broadest that you can really do. So that's why I'm in F-theory. Another application is, it's known that sometimes you learn something about geometry or gauge theory or pure math by studying F-theory. Okay, so let me tell you what F-theory is. F-theory is a theory that can be thought about from three different points of view. The view that I won't take too much in this talk is that of heterotic duality. So when the compactification manifolds satisfy certain properties, and the compactification overall satisfies certain properties, there's a duality between the heterotic string and F-theory. You can map the data accordingly and talk about the gauge theories. One that I will use a little bit more is talking about type 2b. So F-theory has a weakly coupled limit that becomes type 2b, and that's the second way to think about it. And then you can also think about the M-theory compactification on the same geometry to one dimension lower, but then taking this limit M theory on that geometry, when the area of the T2, the elliptic fiber, goes to zero, and I like to think of this as a modern day F equals MA, and that was supposed to be a joke, but it didn't go over very well. Okay, so this is the basic map for how to think about F theory. But one thing that I want to say is that we're going to talk about F theory without resolution. And in particular, we're going to talk about matter from geometry without resolution. And all I want to say about this is I want to make two points. The first is that we're going to make a physics argument to tell you that there exist certain mathematical structures.
So the space-time for F theory is eight-dimensional?
You can think of it somewhat imprecisely as a 12-dimensional theory. So if you want to compactify to four dimensions, you need an 8-manifold, which is your elliptically fibered Calabi F4-fold.
I thought the M theory is supposed to be 10-dimensional. Then you collapse two dimensions. Would that be 8-dimensional?
Mm-hmm. Really, it's a 10-dimensional theory. The elliptic curve, if you think about it as a 12-dimensional theory, the graviton, the gravity is not living in those quote-unquote extra two dimensions. It's really a 10-dimensional theory. This limit is obtained by what's called taking the type 2a limit and then using t-duality to take you to a decompactified type 2b theory, where, I'll say this in a second, one of the fields of the type 2b theory is encoded by the complex structure of the elliptic curve. So I'm going to make a physics argument that certain mathematical structures have to exist, and in particular, that is going to be that there has to be a z to the n description of ADE representations, where n is never the rank of the gauge group. Which is a little bit surprising, because when you think about roots and weights, you like to think of them as vectors in some rank G dimensional vector space. And one point that is another good point about this is that it's become very common in F theory to use resolution, which is a beautiful thing. But what that corresponds to physically is what's called being on the Coulomb branch of the M theory compactification one dimension lower. And one of the problems is that the process by which you resolve does not survive the limit to F theory. So I'm going to give you a process by which you can smooth out the singularities today that actually exist in the F theory limit. Okay. I need to speed up a little. So the view from type 2b in type 2b string theory, there's a field called the axio-dilaton that is a combination of the Ramon-Ramon zero form and I over GS, where GS is the string coupling. And in particular, if you have a D7 brain, so throughout the talk, I'm going to be viewing some sort of the plane of the blackboard here. So my X's will be complex codimension 1 objects. These are really 8-dimensional objects, 7 spatial plus 1 time. And what this defect satisfies, in a way that I will tell you about in a second, is that as you go around it and you study what happens to the tau field, tau goes to tau plus 1. Okay. So this is one of the famous SL2Z actions of type 2B string theory. And in particular, under the generalized SL2Z element, tau goes to A tau plus B over C tau plus D. And the idea of F theory is to have this field modeled by the complex structure of an elliptic curve, and then to consider the fibration of that curve over the BD minus one dimensional space-time compactification.
I'm super confused by the terminology. So I thought this is just a coupling constant.
That's right.
So why would you call this a field?
So it's a fact of string theory that all of the things that you might call constants in quantum field theory are actually determined by what's called the vacuum expectation value of a scalar field. So GS in particular, there's a field called the dilaton in string theory. GS is the vacuum expectation value of e to the phi, where phi is this field. And so it's not really a constant. There are no constant parameters in string
theory. So you always promote all coupling constant in quantum field theory into some expectation.
That's right. That's right. So when I talk about this landscape of vacua, if I imagine having a vacuum, in particular, if you're studying a Calabi-Yau compactification, you'd be at a particular point in the moduli space there, and where you are will determine the vacuum expectation values of these scalar fields and determine the coupling constants at low energies. So that's right. So one of the points here is that this notion of promoting tau to be the complex structure of an elliptic curve is going to give you generalized types of seven brains beyond what you can get in type 2B. So I'm going to study elliptic vibrations a little bit. And the idea is that I have some space-time, and I have some codimension 1 defects in the space-time. Above a generic point, I have a smooth elliptic fiber. And above this codimension 1 locus, I have a singular. That's not how I want to draw it. That didn't work either. Okay, good. It looks singular now. I have a singular elliptic fiber. And in particular, these, of course, can be described mathematically. Elliptically fibered Calabi-Yau manifolds are nice objects. And I'm going to study it in Weierstrass form. Okay. So for those of you that don't know, Weierstrass form is, you can always write something in Weierstrass form in terms of this equation, plus gw to the sixth, where x, y, w live in a weighted projective space P231, where the weights are like so. And you might ask, and I should say also, f and g, x, y, and w are the coordinates of the ambient fiber space. And these f and g are sections of appropriate bundles on the base. And in particular, if you have the Calabi-Yau condition, it's the canonical bundle of the base raised to the minus 4 power and G. So given a particular base, you can construct these sections and write down the Weierstrass equation and study its various properties and what it means physically. So two comments are, why is this an elliptic vibration? The first is that if you look at the scaling degrees, you'll notice that the scaling degree of this equation is the sum of the weights, which is ultimately the Calabi-Yau condition. So you have a Calabi-Yau one-fold, which is an elliptic curve, a compact Calabi-Yau one-fold. Also, you can think of this, if you think of this equation by going to a patch where W equals zero, this equation turns into something that looks like y squared equals v3 of x, a degree polynomial in x. The w equals 0 point is the point at infinity, so ultimately what I have is a double cover of the plane with 4 branch points, which is also an elliptic curve, and I will use that a little bit. So all I want to say is that this is an example that physicists know well and will help jog our memories. If you consider an F-theory compactification to 8 dimensions from 12, you need a complex one-dimensional base. And if you take B equals P1, you get that F is a degree 8 polynomial in the homogeneous coordinates parameterizing the base. G is a degree 12 polynomial. And the terms in that polynomial will have various coefficients, and as you move in the space of those coefficients, you're moving in the complex structure of the elliptic K3, and the physics changes. So what I want to talk about now, this is the generic geometric setup. There is this moduli space of this equation that you can move in, and in some cases, you'll get singularities. In particular, you'll have singular fibers. This will start getting us towards the idea of how matter is arising. So in particular, we have an equation that looks like f of xy equals 0. Right? And if you go at the points in the base where f, its x derivative, and its y derivative vanish, you get a singular fiber. Okay. So in particular, this occurs when the discriminant, which I'm about to define, when delta equals 0, remember f and g are functions of the base coordinates. So when you set this equal to 0, it defines a complex codimension 1 subvariety in the base, and this is where the elliptic fiber is becoming singular. And that's where the fun physics is going to occur. So I should say that given that this is codimension 1 in the base, the total dimension of the discriminant locus is 8 dimensions. So when I told you that there would be generalized 7 brains in F-theory, what I meant is that we would have an 8-dimensional defect that could carry various gauge theoretic structures that in the appropriate type 2b limit would become the D7s and O7s that we know and love. This discriminant is keeping track of that data, and this is one of the main objects of study. So alternatively, another way to think about these singularities is that we have an equation of this form with degree 3 polynomial x, and you have singularities when V3 of x has a double root. So what you should think of in x space, the zeros of this define these three marked points, and as I approach delta equals 0, you're going to see them come together in a particular way. Okay. So one thing that you should be thinking about is when they're coming together in a particular way, this is going to give you a vanishing one cycle in the elliptic fiber, and this is important for thinking about the topology of the total space. For example, if these are two complex codimension 1 points in the base, and I consider what's happening in the fiber, I have some one cycle that has vanished. As I move in the base from this point to this point, the cycle that was vanishing is growing now, and as I get back down over here, it's shrinking again. And depending on some details, it can give you some nice two spheres. And so these one cycles and this distance in the base is associated with two cycles in the total space.
You mentioned a single point and matter. I thought in the Sandburg Wiggins theory is the opposite, that the singularity, the ions massless.
That's right.
So I would say the new matter.
Sorry, the what?
You know, when you say there's matter, are you referring to massive or massless?
I'm going to refer to both things because I'm going to talk about matter in the deformed picture where it's massive, and I'm going to talk about then taking the singular limit when it becomes massless. Okay. But the map to Sieber-Witten theory, while an interesting one, it would take me a little too far afield. This base space is the Coulomb branch of that theory, and there are ways to think about Sieber-Witten theory and F-theory, but I'm thinking about a different sort of matter. So for example, I might associate this distance with some deformation parameter, and then as I undeform the equation, this two cycle will shrink to zero size. Okay. So I get two cycles in the total space in this sort of way. Okay. So in particular, singular fibers in codimension 1 have been classified, which is nice. This is a classification due to Kodaira. In all of these pictures, I'm going to think about the discriminant. The piece that I will be interested in is the locus z equals 0. It will vanish to degree n, and there's some residual piece that might be left over that you can compute in examples. So what Kodaira tells you is to associate certain structures of the singularities with the vanishing of the polynomials, with the order of vanishing of the polynomials along those codimension 1 loci. Okay. And I'm not going to give you this whole classification. I'll just tell you some relevant ones. So if f and g vanish to order 0, and you have the discriminant vanishing to order n, you have what's called an IN fiber, and this is an AN minus 1 singularity. I'll be a little sloppy here in how I present this. So 2, 3, n plus 6 is an IN star singularity, and this is DN plus 4. 4 has an interesting interpretation. So 3, 4, 8, 9, let me just give you the whole thing. 8, 9, 10. Okay, so for some reason, the rank of the singularity goes up. This is E6, E7, E8. But maybe one of the mathematicians can tell me why these fibers are named in decreasing order, 4 star, 3 star, 2 star. Is there a reason to this madness?
Well, there's 2, 3, 4, which are somehow related and which are dual to the 2 star, 3 star, 4 star. So since he had named 2, 3, and 4 already, okay. He's the dual.
Okay, okay. I was, yeah, all right, good. I've been wondering that for a while. All right, so one thing that you should note here, and I'll tell you what these singularities mean in a second, one thing that you should note is that these are only the simply laced guys. The simply laced A, D, and E. In particular, there's no BN, there's no CN, there's no F4, and there's no G2 filling out the classification of simply algebras. So this is this classification, and given what the base is, you can figure out what these F and G can look like. You can move around in their moduli space, you can see things enhance, and you can read off from this table what sort of singularity you have. And to go back to this example, when B is equal to P1, delta is a section of O of 24, which really just means it's a degree 24 polynomial in those variables. And the point is that you have a picture like this, where there's 24 marked points. MP will always be marked points. You can turn off some of the coefficients of these F and G, and as you do, you'll get a picture where some of them zoom together, like so, and depending on how you tune it, it's not really critical for me to write down what the exact tuning is, but the one that I'll study a lot here is when you have a multiplicity 6, where 6 of them have come together, and the claim is that this is a D4 singularity. You can see that because if you have n equals, the structure along f and g would be 2 and 3, and if it's 6 points coming together, the number of marked points here is the order of vanishing of the discriminant. It's also the number of 7 brains. Then we have the D4 case, n equals 0. Okay, so what does this mean? Why D4? I'm going to give you two reasons. The physical reason that, well, they're both physical reasons, but the one that is very nice is in type 2b, there's this sen limit where g string becomes much, much less than 1. In F theory, you can get the type 2b, you can take the type 2b limit and get to this g string much, much less than 1 case. And in particular, when this happens, these 24 defects become 16 O7s, 16 D7 brains at plus 4 O7s. And in particular, something that happens is that these cycles that are labeled in a particular convention as a 1 minus 1 vanishing cycle and a 1 1 vanishing cycle, these two defects in F theory will coalesce in the weak coupling limit to become an O7 plane. Okay, so the reason why I say this is that the 6 marked points in the type 2b limit, if you pick the right ones, become 4d7 plus 07, which if you take them coincident, this is an SO8, which is a D4 gauge theory. So this is why, from a type 2b perspective, this is SO8, but the geometric perspective, in that weak coupling limit, you have open string quantization and other methods to determine gauge symmetry. But what's happening in the geometry is that in M theory, what you have is a codimension 1 locus here. You have a singular fiber. That's a terrible place to draw it. You have a singular fiber off to the side, not a... okay. And then you can resolve the geometry. You can blow it up. And what you'll get, again, I drew it in the wrong spot, you'll get something that looks like that. And what you should notice is that I guess it's the dual graph of the resolution curves that is the Dinkin. But the point is that the Dinkin diagram of D4 is appearing explicitly in the geometry. In particular, the resolution curves, so I'm compactifying here on an elliptic K3, so it's a four manifold, so the curves, I can intersect, and I can ask what their intersection matrix is, and in an appropriate basis, it's exactly minus the Cartan matrix of D4. So you see the Lie algebraic data appearing explicitly in the geometry. And what you should think about is, from an M-theory perspective, when you wrap M2 brains on these curves, these are three-dimensional objects. You're wrapping them on two manifolds. So in the non-compact directions, you have a one-dimensional object left. And when you take the limit, these particles in the non-compact space-time are becoming massless. So this is the sense in which above this defect, where if you resolve it and put M2 brains on it and shrink it back down, you're getting an SO8KH theory. And in particular, this is the Coulomb branch for elliptically... Yes?
I'm confused by the notation. B is the rate of vibration?
Yes.
That's a one-dimensional, or is it
I'm moving around. So when I consider theories in four dimensions,
right.
I'm compactifying on a complex three-dimensional base. But for this simple example, just to sort of see the effect, I'm compactifying on a P1. Sorry, an elliptic vibration over P1. K3. That's a little ambiguous. So on the elliptic fourfold, you can get a similar sort of effect. If you have a singularity, you can move in the enlarged Kähler cone that will resolve it, and this corresponds to moving on what's called the M-theory Coulomb branch. Just wanted to say that, because I want to contrast it with what I'm going to do. But first I want to tell you about codimension 2 singularity enhancement. Okay. So here I'll just be a little quick. So now imagine that I'm compactifying on an elliptic threefold to six dimensions, or more generically, that I just have a complex codimension 2 sublocus in the base. Various things can happen. So, and I should say that there's no classification of these singularities in codimension 2. You have to do them sort of example by example. But this is where matter starts to appear. And so what I want to do is this plane, instead of being the z plane now, this is a z equals 0 locus. And I have another local coordinate, t equals 0, that gets a 0 there. And what I want to consider is if I have, for example, an AR singular fiber here, and at t equals 0, I enhance to an AR plus 1 singular fiber. In complex codimension 2, I now have more curves in the resolution picture. So there's more M2 brain states that I can wrap on it. And in particular, if you keep track of the details, in codimension 2, I have an adjoint of AR plus 1's worth of curves. Now, in codimension 1, I have an adjoint of AR's worth of curves. And the point is, these are the curves. The curves filling out this representation is what I have in codimension 1. In codimension 2, I have all of these curves, which means that I have some new curves that are corresponding to these fundamentals and anti-fundamentals that are becoming light in codimension 2. So I have extra shrunken 2 cycles in the codimension 2 locus, and this is how you get matter. This is sort of the F-theory version of intersecting D7 brains. I should say also that there's more complicated examples. So in particular, the curve I was considering here had simple normal crossing, where the discriminant goes like z to the r plus 1 times t. And the discriminant components are intersecting in this sort of way. But you can have more complicated examples. Maybe you have one discriminant locus, and it intersects with something else at a cusp or something like this. So Dave has studied these things extensively with Waddy Taylor and with Antonella Grassi and with other people in the physics literature. So be sure to look at those papers. What I want to tell you about is how you get non-simply laced algebras. Okay, so this is a beautiful story. And it's well known mathematically. But what I want to do is I want to consider non-simply laced. So remember that according to Khodaira's classification, I could only get simply laced Lie group singularities in codimension 1, which when I resolve them will give me those corresponding gauge algebras. But I want to tell you about a special feature that can happen now. I'm going to write down the equation for the geometry later, but I'm not going to write it down right now. But the basic story, I want you to consider an example. So in this z equals 0 locus, suppose that I have a D4 singularity. Okay. Now, this isn't always true, but in certain special cases, there's a singularity enhancement in codimension 1, and it can have an interesting effect in certain cases. And in the case that we'll study a little more explicitly, as you go around this T equals 0 locus, the singular fiber exists within at every point here. As you go around, you can ask, what happens to these resolution curves? Very often, nothing happens, but in some cases, what happens when you go around is that this picture that looked like this, as you went around, the curves on the external chunk of the Dinkin swapped around, and in particular, geometrically and also on the algebra, this is giving you a Z3 automorphism. And in doing so, when you think about the corresponding physical theory, if you had an M2 brain here on this guy, when you go around, how do you tell them from that one or that one? You cannot tell under the monodromy, and so in particular, you should identify those states. So you identify the outer nodes, and what you get, these three lines come down and map you to the Dinkin of G2. This is D4, and it becomes G2. So this is how non-simply laced algebras arise in complex codimension 1 in singular elliptic vibrations, but physically in F-theory, this can give you is it precise to say that you can actually get a G2 gauge group, or?
Yes.
Okay, good. I know that there's some subtleties sometimes with calling something a group that has a particular singularity, right?
G2 is simply connected, so there's no ambiguity in that case.
Good, okay. Thanks.
What gives you the cyclic order? Why is not S3 instead of Z3? There's no problem finally.
Yeah, so this was something that sort of confused me a little bit during this project. So the most generic automorphism of this thing is a full S3's worth, not a Z3. But if I go around, and this automorphism is generated just by going around this T equals 0 locus, I don't see how I get anything other than a Z3.
Well, I don't have a planar, you know, cyclic order, so there's no reason I don't see, you know, anyway, I just don't know if you have a way to
I only see the full. I only see the Z3 here, not the full S3. The most generic automorphism would be an S3. But are you saying that the geometry is actually realizing the S3?
Well, I don't see any way to distinguish the two.
So this is a local picture, and what's going on a little more globally is that we've got some kind of locus in the base, and we've got a three-sheeted cover of that locus, and we've got certain ramification points. And this is measuring the type of ramification. But, for example, the Galois group of the full thing can be S3, not C3. Mm-hmm. So it's only because we're looking just at one place and we only have one direction to go that we're singling out a particular Z3, even though the S3 will be the full. The full S3 automorphism will be there.
It will be there in certain cases. Interesting. I didn't know that. But you're saying locally this is an abelian action, but globally something more. Good. I didn't know that. So that's why I was confused in the literature. Because I think it does say that in your paper with Bershadsky et al, right? It says S3. And presumably this is what you have in mind.
Sadly, there are many imprecise statements in that paper.
Okay. All right. So this is all review. This is the standard picture in F-theory, and you know, it's really mathematical techniques. You can use it for other things. for how you use resolution to talk about ADE representations, Lie algebra representations, and what they might correspond to in physics. So just to review, in codimension 1, we have the gauge theories and their adjoint representations living, but in codimension 2, you can have extra curves that appear that are giving rise to matter representations. So hopefully at this point, the physicists may have some objections. I just told you this nice story about these resolution curves, but you sort of may be asking, in this picture, where are the seven brains? The sort of natural seven-brain depiction for how string theorists usually think about giving mass to states, it's sort of absent here. I mean, you have this seven-brain in codimension one, and the thing that's gotten big is this thing above it. I'll be precise about this in a moment. In particular, in type 2b, when you have W bosons that are getting a mass, what you typically think of, if you have 2d7 brains here, you think of what some people might call brain splitting. You split the 2d7s, which were coincident, into 2d7s, and you can have open string states going between them, and you have broken the gauge group down. In doing so, the W bosons have gotten a mass, and they're represented by these finite length strings. And here, I explicitly split the seven brains, whereas here I'm doing something above it. It's a different sort of picture. Another, and I should say that this is where the physics arguments are going to come in. When you have heterotic duality, you can turn on an E8 gauge bundle. It's a holomorphic vector bundle over a Calabi-Yau threefold if you're going to four dimensions. And if the vector bundle has EH structure group, this implies that you have to have 240 massive W bosons. Remember, the adjoint of E8 is 248 dimensional, so there's 240 non-Cartan guys. And the big but here is that under heterotic F3 duality, these vector bundle moduli, you can be very explicit about all of this, become complex structure moduli, in particular, not Kähler. Kähler and the Coulomb branch of M-theory is all about resolution. This is something else. And the picture that you get in F-theory when you have such a process is that you have something like an E8 singularity, and what you get, and here is very precise, you get 10 marked points. And this is an interesting thing. First of all, this picture is different than this resolution picture of the gauge algebra that I just told you about. So let me call it a physics prediction. Okay. So you might not be surprised that there exists 240 W bosons from deformation, this movement in the complex structure. But which isn't that surprising. These W bosons are corresponding to two cycles. If I tell you I resolved the singularities via deformation, it's not surprising that these guys are getting a finite volume. But the somewhat surprising thing to me, at least, is that there's 10 marked points. So in particular, the roots should be represented as vectors in z to the n, where remember n is generically the symbol that I'm using for the order of vanishing along the codimension 1 discriminant. And this is never, I'll draw multiple arrow slashes through it, this is never the rank of the gauge group. Okay, so this is a funny thing. And maybe I'll make some comments about the generic picture. But sorry, and in the E8 case, it's specifically in NE8, which happens to be 10. So the roots will be sitting in z to the 10, not z to the 8. At least that's what you expect from physics. The physics statement is that the theory is totally Higgs. You have moved these 10 defects out. You expect all of them to play an important role in the gauge algebra. And so you expect that these generalized string states going between all different combinations of the 10. And if you represent those string states as vectors, and their roots in two cycles and all these maps, then it should be sitting in Z10. Okay, so the general picture is that the discriminant, this is not just an E8 case, is generically going like Z to the N. My picture is that I have a multiplicity N defect. And when I deform, getting something. Okay. This is N marked points. I just want to make a few comments. The number, in physics language, the number of marked points is equal to, from a type 2b perspective, at least near this locus, this is the number of seven brains after you deform. Associated to each marked point, they come with vanishing cycles, pi I. Remember that the fiber is becoming singular above each of these marked points. So that's going to be part of the important data. I'm in the wrong part. No, I'm not. Good. Okay. Three is that, and this is the generic case, the non-abelian part of the gauge group, abelian parts are more complicated in F theory, G is Higgs. So you have to have you have to have all of your W bosons massive, so you have to have a two-cycle from the M-theory perspective for all of them, and in particular, the two cycles are going to be related to vectors in Zn, as I've emphasized, and in case it's not clear, these are not the resolution two cycles. They're represented in a different way. Okay. So this is sort of the pivot point of my talk, where I presented this picture of resolution, and now I want to talk about deformation of singularities and various interesting things that occur, and of course I have opinions about cool things that you learn from it, and reasons why it's nice enough theory, but I'll get to those if I have time. Are there any questions before I proceed on to this other picture? Just to give you an example one more time for how these pictures differ, if I have an SU2 singular fiber and I resolve, I still have this point here, but I have this new curve appearing in the fiber. If I deform, and in higher dimensional Calabi-Yau varieties, this is movement in the Kähler moduli space, and this is movement in complex structure. This is deformation, and this is this picture where in the base, I have split the marked points. There's two multiplicity one marked points. There's a vanishing fiber above this one. There's a vanishing fiber here. And in the total space, there's an associated two cycle. And you might, if you project down to the base, associate that with a string. Okay. So I want to tell you the generic steps for the analysis. So these ideas are based on ideas that Schwinkler studied in the late 90s, some beautiful works by Barton Zwieback and collaborators, in particular Oliver DeWolf. They call these things string junctions, and I'm going to sort of present them systematically here and give you some new results. So the steps for an analysis are as follows. The first thing, given a singular geometry, deform it in such a way such that you have this singular fiber along z equals 0, and all of these guys get split up. So you've split the one marked point with multiplicity n into n multiplicity one marked points. Okay. So, and I should say that I'm gonna stick to elliptic surfaces for now, but I'm gonna say some things about higher codimension later. So choose a base point P, and once you do that, choose a path around the PI. So if I'm in the z-plane, I have a couple of these guys. Let me, as if I have some deformation parameter epsilon and I send it to 0, you can imagine these guys coming together. But I've split them out, and I might as well just take the base point to be this thing in the middle. There's a singular fiber above this, this, and this. This is P1 with vanishing cycle pi 1. This is p2 with pi 2. And this is p3 with pi 3. And the point is that you can determine what cycles are vanishing by starting at the base point and following a path to the vanishing cycle. And as this happens, remember that the equation looks like y squared equals v3 of x. And so in this x space, the singularity occurs when you have a double root. So as you move towards one of these marked points that has the vanishing one cycle, some of these guys will come together, and you can read the data off from this and determine in some basis what these pi 1, pi 2, and pi 3 are that are the one cycles that are vanishing above the marked points. So in particular, in choosing a path around the PI, you might say something like, okay, first I'm going to go around this one, then I'm going to go around this one, and then I'm going to go around this one. And in doing so, you're really picking an ordered set of vanishing cycles, pi 1, pi 2, pi 3. In our paper, we talk about this in the language of Picard-Lefschetz theory. When you study, there's an action, a monodromy action on the one cycles in the smooth elliptic fibers as you move around these, and this is ultimately the monodromy action of associated with the singular fibers. But this is the data that's going to be critical for us, is an ordered set of vanishing one cycles. And you could say, what do you mean? How is it ordered? So you could imagine another case like this, with these three marked points, where I say, okay, first I'm going to go to this one, but then I'm going to go to this one, and then I'm going to go to this one along this path. So you've changed the order of what marked point you go to in which order. The vanishing cycles will be the same as you approach the points along the same paths, because you're reading them off explicitly from the geometry. But as you go to this one, the one cycle will be different. You can read this off. So in particular, this configuration would have a different ordered set. You would have, here you went 1, 2, 3. Here you're first going to 1, then you're going to 3. And then you're going to point P2, but it now has a different vanishing cycle. And string theorists are familiar with this. You can do standard SL2Z conjugation to compute these sorts of things. Mathematically, it's Picard-Lefschetz theory, but it's standard SL2Z types of actions in string theory, standard monodromy. So, so this is the big point, is that in picking a path around the defects from the base point, I've determined an ordered set of vanishing cycles. And when I told you about the code at the beginning, the input of the code for all of the algebraic analyses that get you all of this neat representation theoretic stuff is an ordered set of n vanishing cycles. Once you have that data, you can just plug it in, you can do various algebraic analyses, but that's really the input data. And mathematically, in string theory, it just corresponds to writing down the PQ labels of the PQ7 brains. The PQ cycle is vanishing above each 7 brain. There's various different cycles, and in doing so, in writing down this set, you're really just giving these labels. Okay. So I have 15 more minutes and 3 more pages, so that's about right. Okay. So I just want to make a quick definition. An appropriate basis, I'm going to define pi A to be 1, 0. Pi B. Okay, so Tor, I have 2 one cycles, and these are the labels for these particular one cycles in this A and B cycle basis, which I realize is ambiguous now that I'm calling them these things. So these are labeling particular one cycles in the elliptic curve. And the thing that you want to do is represent a 2 manifold by some J equals J1 dot 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 Jn, Kodaira is n, the order of vanishing of the discriminant in Zn. And these vectors are corresponding to these 2 manifolds, and they're giving 2 manifolds in the total space, or you could think if you project it down to the base, it's giving a 1 manifold, also known as a string junction in the string theory literature. And I'll give you some examples in a minute that makes this clear, but I want to define one other thing first. So the asymptotic charge is defined to be sum over ji pi I. So in particular, this is a one cycle. Physically, the reason why it's asymptotic is the question as you wrap the M2 brains on these two manifolds and it goes away from the codimension one locus, what one cycle in the elliptic fiber is it wrapping? So just a simple example. Okay, so if I want to do SU5, I need 5 marked points. I'll call this alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, alpha 4, suggestively. So remember that the blackboard is the base, we have an elliptic vibration over it. You see the one-dimensional objects, but you know that there's vanishing cycles at these points. In the total space, really, this alpha is a two-cycle. Oh, and there's one more I wanted to find. And it pinches off in both spots. And here, I have one, this line here, and I'll call this line F. And in particular, this end is open, and represent them as vectors in the obvious way. 1 minus 1 because it goes from that one to that one and doesn't end on any of the other 3 defects. Similarly for the other ones, F is 1, and this, it turns out, is related to the fundamental representation. It's the statement that you have a string coming off this 7 brain and it can go end somewhere else. And here A of alpha I is 0, 0, which is the statement that there's no one cycle that's wrapping asymptotically far away, which is also the statement that it's pinching off. It comes out of here, and then it pinches off there. Whereas this one's coming out, but it has a loose end. And there are more generic things you could write down. One thing that's critical to this story, you imagine in the resolution picture, because the topological intersection product of two cycles is the thing that becomes the Lie algebra product, that something similar might happen here. So in particular, what you want is a map from Zn times Zn to Z, just a matrix that computes the product on these vectors in Zn that represent these two manifolds. And maybe I'll just tell you the story that we write down a generic formula in our paper for this thing. There's two contributions it receives. You might imagine having a more generic junction where you have marked points like this and they can come together in a particular way. So you can get contributions to the topological intersection from these fixed points. And there are also these what are called junction points that can also contribute. So we write down a generic formula for this in our paper. Given an ordered set of vanishing cycles, you can just write down a matrix, which is this intersection product. And the point is that it exactly reproduces. So for example, here, AI, AJ for the roots gives you the negative of the Cartan matrix. But the matrix here is a 5x5 matrix instead of a 4x4. The intersection product. So let me just say a few more things before I get to my example. No, I'll write this down. Okay. So there are these beautiful works by Zwieback and DeWolf. And they define what I will call the canonical basis. And the canonical basis is for every ADE group, they write down an ordered set of vanishing cycles that they can use to do these algebraic computations. So, for example, ZD4 that they write down is pi A 4 times, and then pi B, pi C, and this is the thing that you know well from type 2B, that's in the type 2B limit, these pi A's are becoming the D7 brains, they can coalesce, the B and C come together to be an O7, and that's giving you the SO8 gauge symmetry. They do it for every ADE group. You can also determine other bases via the method that I was telling you about over here a few minutes ago, using these passive approach to the marked points. But I want to tell you a couple of facts and then get to my final example and conclude. So, given this product and this formalism, it gives you a way of having string junction representations, which is really related to these two manifolds in the geometry, a way of getting ADE states that are that are represented by vectors in Zn. This product is an n by n matrix, where n is not the rank of the gauge group, and you might ask, can you get non-trivial representations? In particular, remember in Lie theory that once you have the Cartan matrix, you can get the simple roots out of it and get the entire algebraic structure. And if I want to talk about a representation, if you give me the highest weight and the roots, I can generate the entire level diagram of the representation and get all of the representation theoretic data there that representation has. And in particular, there's something called Freudenthal's formula. There's other versions, but there's other useful formulas you can use. The one that I used for this project was Freudenthal's formula, which, given the simple roots and the highest weight, is a systematic recursion formula for subtracting off the simple roots and generating the entire representation. The question is, does it work in this case for this product and this way of representing these two manifolds? And the answer is that it does. We have just a couple of examples. This 126 of SO10 as a two-manifold, not as a two-cycle, is realized in this case. And Freudenthal's formula, if you start with the highest weight as a junction, which here would be a vector in Z7, it will generate the entire 126-dimensional representation. But you know, just because you can do crazy things. E6 is, so in Kodaira's classification, E6 vanishes with order 8. Okay, so E6 has a 43,758-dimensional representation. We, in our paper, found the vector in Z8 that represents this thing, and used Freudenthal's formula to generate the entire representation, and it gets the counting right. And there's some caveats that you're probably worried about that maybe I'll comment on in a second. The last thing that I want to say about the representation theory is that we also wrote down a generic map, F from Zn to Zr, where R is the rank of the gauge group. So in particular, if I'm telling you that I can represent roots of E8 as vectors in Z10, you say, you must be crazy unless it's only spanning a rank 8 sublattice. That's exactly what it's doing. It has to if it's actually the root lattice of E8. And this map that we wrote down takes this junction representation, represented as these vectors, and gives it to you back in the Dinkin basis. So take string junctions and it maps you to the Dinkin basis. The Dinkin basis is just a useful basis for writing down weights of the algebra representations. And you can take the string junction that represents the highest weight of this state, compute this map, act on this object with it, and go to the back of Slansky. Slansky is this group theory reference that particle physicists, including myself, love. And it has a table, and you can check that the highest weight acted on by that map gives you something in the Dinkin basis that's exactly what you get from the back of Slansky. So it really seems that we're getting non-trivial Lie algebra structure. You can do a similar codimension 2 story where you can get matter, and I'll comment on that if I have time afterwards. What I want to talk about is this D4 to G2 example. So remember in the resolution picture that in the complex codimension 1 locus, the resolved fiber gives you this D4, and as you move around T equals 0, the codimension 2 singular locus, there's this outer automorphism that acts on the Dinkin that maps D4 to G2. Now, we're going to try the same thing in the deformation picture. And here is the promised curve that I told you I would write down. Okay. So y and x are my elliptic fiber coordinates. T and z are my local coordinates in the base. Z equals t equals 0 is my codimension 2 singularity. These a's and c's are just various parameters. And epsilon is my deformation parameter. So in particular, delta here, this discriminant that tells you about the seven brains, looks like at plus 4c cubed z cubed plus epsilon t. Note the explicit t dependence here, times a z cubed plus epsilon. So the zeros of this give in codimension 1 give you three marked points, really codimension 1 loci, that depend on t, and there's the other three roots that don't. So the picture that you get, let the ones that don't just represent them by dots. This is the z-plane. I'm going to represent by stars. That's a terrible star. These ones that do depend on t. And I'm going to fix Remember that there's also the x-plane. My elliptic vibration is y squared equals v cubed x. And as you approach the singular points in the base, some number of these points are coming together. And let me call these paths pi alpha, pi beta, pi gamma. And the point is this. My deformation parameter, as I turn epsilon off, all of these 6 points will come in. With epsilon on, they all move out, and the geometry is smooth, even though you have these singular fibers. They just have I1 singularities. And this ordered set of vanishing cycles, so as you take this base point P, and you go to these points on various paths, you can see which of these guys are pinching off. You get pi alpha, pi beta, pi gamma, pi alpha, pi beta, pi gamma. So as you go to different mark points, you get different cycles pinching off. This is the input for the analysis. The question is, does it really give you a D4 algebra when you study this intersection product? It does, so let me just tell you some of the checks. So you can check that the monodromy, the Picard-Lefschetz monodromy, induced by this guy is of the right structure. You can compute S. Let S be the number of let S be the set of vectors with self-intersection -2 and asymptotic charge 0. Turns out there's exactly 24 of these, which is the counting that you need for the roots. The level diagram, if you compute the level diagram of these junctions, the topology of the level diagram matches what it needs to from representation theory, and if you calculate the number of sets of simple roots out of this set of roots, you get 192, which is the dimension of the Weyl group, which is exactly what you need. So this ordered set of vanishing cycles and this formalism can give you D4. Now, in particular, in the resolution picture, I had 4 curves. Here I have 6 mark points. And the question is, do you still get this same sort of structure? So as t goes to e to the pi t, what you want to do is you want to track the 1 cycles. What Mathematica is great at this. You can vary this p parameter, and as you go around t equals 0, you can just say what is happening to this picture that I've drawn, tracking both what happens to these points and what happens to these. And what happens, so I told you that there's only 3 of these points have t dependence, and these are the ones that move, and they go like this. Okay? And the 1 cycles also move around in a particular way that has a z3. So at each point for p, so really what I gave you here is zp equals 0. You can ask, what are the vanishing cycles at zp equals 2 pi? And it goes beta, gamma, alpha, beta, gamma, alpha. And at p equals 4 pi, it's gamma, alpha, beta, gamma, alpha, beta. And by that, I mean beta, gamma, and alpha defined with respect to the vanishing, with respect to this 1 cycle basis at p equals 0. Clearly, if every time you go around, you allow yourself to redefine the 1 cycles, that's not the way to do it. So this is the map that you get. There's the obvious z3. You can ask yourself the question, how does it act on the algebra? There were 2 arguments in our paper for how this changing of the ordered set of vanishing cycles acts on the algebra. And I'll present a simple one. Okay, and the simple one is this. So I have a picture like this, and let this object coming off here be JP. So in the total space, it's sort of, it's shrinking here, but then it's growing, and it's this loose-ended two-manifold that might go end something on something else in the compactification. And in particular, all of these JP have self-intersection minus 1. But the interesting thing is that the asymptotic charge at J0 is pi alpha. The asymptotic charge of this object at P equals 2 pi is pi beta. And the asymptotic charge at 4 pi is pi gamma. And in particular, so all of this formalism gives you a way of asking, given a set of junctions, what representation is it fitting into? And you can show that J0 gives you an 8 vector of SO8. J2 pi fits into an 8 spinner. And J4 pi fits into an 8 conjugate spinner. So this is the map that is happening to this same object as you move around t equals 0. And of course, as you keep doing it, there's goes back to itself. But so it turns out that this triality of these eight-dimensional representations of SO8 happens exactly. There's a way of associating these three eight-dimensional representations with the outer nodes, and permuting them under this geometric action is permuting the outer nodes of the algebra, which is happening when D4 goes to G2. So this is the simple way of showing that in the deformation picture, when you have this D4, this SO8 algebra represented in Z6 instead of Z4, the geometric action on this guy is mapping D4 to G2 in the way that you would expect. And well, that's all I really had to say. So thank you very much.
I have lots of questions, but maybe I'll ask them later.
Great. Excellent. That's good. Thank you. Can I just turn it off?
Let's stop first.